Born woman is believed to be the first member of the migrant caravan to have a child in the United States after scaling a border wall with her family and giving birth within 24 hours. This move is reigniting the debate surrounding anchor babies and birthright citizenship. Linda Vega is an immigration attorney. She joins Fox News and says what's next regarding this woman's plea for asylum.
If she's found not to be credible, she then goes before an immigration judge to determine whether she's credible to remain in the United States. But even if she's determined credible, that could take months or years until they possibly get to her case.
And if her claims for asylum are not credible, Vega says?
Well, if she's found not credible, then she has the option to argue that case before an immigration judge. And if the judge finds her not to be credible, she's deported at that point. Now, even though the baby's born on U.S. soil, it's a U.S. citizen, but the baby has to go back with her at that point.
Right.
Unless the baby becomes a ward of the state.
Please remember, you can always check us out online at usaradio.com. For USA Radio News, I'm Tim Berg.
Well, good afternoon. I could comment on that most recent on the news. Yes, in fact, anybody born in the United States is a citizen of the United States, and as it should be, in my opinion, and obviously based on our Constitution, that's the case. I have one of my children was born outside of the United States in another country, so of course, based on her birth, she was a citizen of that country. And the reason that she is a citizen of the United States is that when parents who are citizens of the United States, as were my husband and myself, then she was entitled to citizenship based on that basis. So she really didn't need to be naturalized in any other way. However, I have to say that it is true that if this woman who just had a baby in the United States, if her claims for asylum are not granted, she doesn't have specific reasons, and it is not easy to get asylum, but if she doesn't have sufficient reasons, then she will be deported. And the fact is that many U.S. citizen children are deported because they go back to the countries with their parents when the parents are deported. There would be certain other ways that the child could stay here if, in fact, the mother wanted the child to stay here with relatives, etc. However, once again, you know, they have to have all this dramatic, you know, as if the people are invading our country, etc., etc. Actually, I cannot imagine what it must have been like for this woman who was obviously 9 months pregnant because she had this baby, maybe not quite 9 months pregnant, but she had this baby within 24 hours of coming across the border. So this, you know, had to be incredibly stressful for this woman and, of course, for the baby. But I guess the fact that someone who is that pregnant, almost about to deliver a baby, would take that risk to come into this country, people should at least take a look at why and what this woman was escaping from in order to do that. And I think any woman out there who has had children would, you know, would have to think twice about what would be the impetus for her at almost 9 months pregnant or 9 months pregnant to take such a strenuous journey. But anyway, this is Pat Smits. I am expressing my own views, just as the news expressed their views. But I do have probably different views than many people based on the fact that I did live in a country that was very dangerous, and people are coming from Guatemala because of the danger. And, of course, interestingly, I didn't hear the news talking about how Donald Trump has illegal immigrants, or I should say undocumented immigrants, working right here in New Jersey at his golf course in Bedminster. So let's, I suppose he's just going to say, you know, somebody else does the hiring and the checking of credentials. But in any event, this is very common that many wealthy people have undocumented immigrants working. And in this case, the woman in question was working as a maid. In any event, let's talk about the weather. And as soon as we talk about the weather, we'll come back with the program, It's the Law. And, of course, what I've just been talking about goes to legal issues. And, again, I just want to remind everyone that anyone coming either to the border or illegally crossing the border who requests amnesty, they have a right to have their amnesty request determined. And although the whoever was speaking on the news said this could take years, generally now the policy is they're taking the most recent immigrants first, and because they think that'll be easier to send them back. So yes, it can take years, but that, from my understanding, they've really been speeding up the process and doing this very quickly and taking the last people to come across first rather than the other way around, which has left many, many people in limbo. So what's happening today, the 7th of December? Actually, it was a beautiful day out. Although it said it was only about 35 degrees, it really seemed warmer, especially in the sun. And in fact, tomorrow is supposed to be mostly sunny, again about 35 degrees. Tomorrow night, mostly clear. And again on Sunday, mostly sunny and a high of about 39 degrees. So certainly in the sun, it's going to be very nice working outside. By Monday, it's still mostly sunny, high of about 41 degrees. So if you haven't put up decorations and you're still planning to, looks like there's going to be 4 days if you have time during the day, because again on Tuesday it's going to be sunny and high of about 38 degrees. So I'll be back with the program It's a Law in just a minute after we hear from some of our sponsors.
On Thursday, November 8th, from 2 till 7 p.m., the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce will be holding its 30th Annual Business Expo and Food Showcase, presented by PNC Bank. It will be held at Next Level Arena in Flemington, featuring over 100 exhibitors, demos, a chance to enter the...
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce. Building business, one business at a time.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com, brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
This is Tony Clark, para planner at Patton Heidi & Associates. Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they will live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Patton Heidi & Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. We are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Patton Heidi & Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you pursue your retirement goals. Call today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 1318 Route 31 North, Annandale, New Jersey. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor, Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC.
Okay, I'm back. Pat Smith, the program is the law. And before I go into what I'm talking about today, I just wanted to remind you that there's going to be an excellent program for business owners. It's called Protect Your Business. It's going to be next week on December 12th from 8 until 10 a.m. here at the Chamber, 119 Main Street in Flemington. And the Mr. Fenimore from Unity Bank, he's the Chief Regulatory Compliance, or CRA, Officer. And David Bove, Senior Vice President and Chief Technology Officer at Unity Bank. They're going to be giving a program with a cybercrime theme. In other words, we all know cybercrime is on the rise, and small businesses are increasingly being targeted for fraud. If you haven't, received some kind of fraudulent phone call, something on the computer, it's only a matter of time. So in working with hundreds of small business customers, this course will review some of the alarming trends and case studies and preventative measures to help safeguard our businesses. And it will also discuss the ever-changing trends in cybersecurity and also cover best practices to protect our businesses. So I really recommend that. I think we all need more information on this. And then there's another program on December 14th here at the Chamber from 9 until 11. And it is going to be Secrets to Success in Social Media Marketing course. I can tell you this is certainly someone or a course that I could use. I have one of those people that initially was kind of on the cutting edge of computers, and now I'm certainly not and do not use media, social media for marketing. But this can be very successful in almost any kind of business. And, the focus is going to be creating a strategy for marketing our specific businesses using social media, and then to find where our target audience hangs out online, and also creating an advertising plan and budget with respect to handling this type of marketing. So contact the Chamber for either of these, participate in either of these programs to register. The number is 908-782-7115, and you can get more information by calling the Chamber about these programs. Okay, so what's happening in the law? Well, there was a new trial ordered in an automobile case for a plaintiff who was grilled on immigration status and English skills. So it was a Bergen County automobile injury case based on cross-examination of the Colombian-born plaintiff during the trial with respect to his citizenship, how long he had lived in the United States, and his need for an interpreter. So that was considered, just absolutely inappropriate in light of the case. So the case is, and this was an appellate division, the case was decided on December 6th, yesterday, and the plaintiff in that case appealed from a judgment entered on a jury's verdict that found the defendant 80% negligent and the plaintiff 20% negligent for the rear-end collision between the parties. At trial, the defendant did not deny being partially responsible for the accident, but argued that the plaintiff was also partially liable. However, the defendant's trial testimony differed from his interrogatory answers, which means that in litigation, litigants are served with questions. That's interrogatories are questions that they have to answer, and also in this case differed from the interrogatory answers, the police report, and from the plaintiff's version of the accident. So remember, in this case, the jury verdict found the defendant 80% negligent and the plaintiff 20% negligent. And it was a rear-end collision. So the what else happened? Well, that was one of the problems in the case as far as for the defendant. The parties also disputed whether plaintiff's herniated discs were caused by the accidents. So could have been caused by something else. Plaintiff's surgeon testified that his injuries were caused by the accident and that his prognosis for complete recovery was poor. Now, the defendant's medical expert opined that the herniations were caused by a degenerative process. And this is always the problem in accidents, especially rear-end accidents when somebody suffers some kind of a back injury. Is it because of normal degeneration or because of age, or did the accident cause it? So on appeal, the plaintiff argued that the trial court erred by permitting defense counsel to bring up the concept of secondary gain, and that's a quote, secondary gain, during the cross-examination of one of the plaintiff's medical witnesses, even though no witnesses opined that plaintiff was experiencing secondary gain. So that was one issue. Now, plaintiff further argued that the trial court erroneously denied plaintiff's motion for a directed verdict on liability and granted the defendant's motion to bar plaintiff's expert opinion on life care plan. The court agreed that the cumulative effects of errors during the trial, now this was the appellate division, they agreed that the cumulative effects of errors during the trial prejudiced the plaintiff and warranted the grant of a new trial. So plaintiff was entitled to a new trial based on these errors. Now, the court found that the defense counsel's statement throughout the trial were not relevant to the evidence presented, but instead arguably appealed to the prejudice of the jury. So that was significant. Instead of arguing the evidence, he was arguing and cross-examining in a way to seem apparently a blatant attempt to prejudice the jury. So, in particular, the defense counsel's reference to a litigious society was one of the questions and questionable comments. And also, probably more important, was questioning the defendant about his immigration and citizenship status, mentioning the fact that plaintiff's airbags did not deploy without first presenting support on expert testimony and injecting the concept of a secondary gain without any documentary evidence or medical testimony. However, the court ruled that the plaintiff was not entitled to a directed verdict on liability because the evidence could support the jury finding of plaintiff was partially at fault. So remember, the plaintiff was found only 20% at fault, and the defendant was found 80%. But still, it was the plaintiff who filed for a new trial, or actually he filed asking the court, the appellate court, to reverse it because he didn't feel he should be found 20% negligent. So the takeaway from this, however, to me, is that the prejudice, the possible prejudice to the defendant because of his immigrant status. Now, there was another case, a constitutional law case, and it was not published, but I think it's of interest, is Helfman versus State Board of Psychological Examiners. And this certainly, professionals are always interested in cases brought by, you know, the various bar association as far as lawyers, and that would there's an ethics. One of the things we're all very concerned about is making sure that we follow all of the ethical rules that lawyers are held to. So in this case, the plaintiff appealed the dismissal of his complaint alleging defendants, and the defendants were the State Board of Psychological Examiners, had deprived him of his property interest and caused his reputation to be damaged and also economic loss. So what happened is a newspaper published an article about a collection action filed by the plaintiff's lawyer against a patient. The Deputy Attorney General investigated the matter and filed a complaint against the plaintiff with the Board of Psychological Examiners. Plaintiff sued defendants alleging they violated his property rights under the Equal Protection Clause. Defendants moved to dismiss for failure to state a cause of action, and the trial judge granted the motion, finding the defendants were entitled to absolute immunity, and the court found the plaintiff's arguments were without sufficient merit to warrant discussion and affirmed the reasons expressed by the trial judge. So they made short shrift of that one. So what is the takeaway from this? Well, you have to be careful, I guess, because what happened is because the psychologist sued a patient, and that became reported, then the attorney general investigated the matter and filed the complaint. So this, although it's not a published case, it is important for people who are, in fact, the psychologists, lawyers, other people who can run into problems with their professional boards. There were not a lot of things published this past week. There was an unpublished case, civil rights, education law, student, N.W., appealed the dismissal of his law against discrimination complaint. And in that case, plaintiff was a high school student, and the student and other students were escorted off the school premises after school had ended by a security guard and the vice principal. The plaintiff got into an altercation with the security guard and alleged the security guard pushed him and used racially abusive language. The student asserted that the racially hostile language discouraged him from returning to school. And apparently the school investigation concluded that a video did not corroborate the student's story, but that the guard might have used racially hostile language, and therefore they suspended the guard for 5 days. The student asserted that the discrimination in the course of a public accommodation, and the parties acknowledged that it was a single incident case, and the court granted summary judgment to the defendants, finding that the remarks were outside the scope of the guard's employment. So that's interesting. That was the interesting part about this. Because of his remarks, were they outside of his employment? Therefore, did the defendants have, could use that for a defense? So the court noted that plaintiff's ability to attend school, this is the appellate division, that the plaintiff's ability to attend school was not impaired, and that the plaintiff sought to hold the school liable for a single incident of an unauthorized comment by a low-level employee, which, of course, was in violation of the school district's anti-harassment policy. So it wasn't as if the school had the policy this employee basically was acting on its own. So the court found that the defendant had no actual or even constructive notice that a school guard would engage in such behavior. And also there was no evidence that the school acted to discourage the plaintiff from attending school, and the defendant investigated the incident and meted out disciplinary action. So basically what the court said is the school did what they needed to do. And and there's no question that it was inappropriate language. It's just that they did not, meaning the court did not feel that the defendant's school system was liable or could be held liable. There was another family law case. Again, it wasn't reported, but it's rather interesting because in this case, the defendant appealed a dual final judgment of divorce and argued that the trial judge abused her discretion in giving the plaintiff the sole marital asset, which was the marital home. So obviously assets are equitably distributed in after divorce, and in this case the judge awarded the wife the home. So the court found, and the appellate division that is, the court found that the trial judge properly applied the factors under the statute to the party's circumstances and found that plaintiff was entitled to all proceeds from the sale of the party's property, which would be used to pay plaintiff's, which would be used to pay plaintiff's attorney fees, reimburse expenses paid on behalf of the children, and satisfy judgment creditors. The trial judge noted that the defendant had defaulted on loans and failed to pay family expenses. So neither res judicata nor the law of the case doctrine precluded the equitable distribution. And then a separate lawsuit regarding the validity of loans did not litigate issues of equitable distribution. So that's important because that still was something that the judge had to determine. So the record also supported the trial judge's conclusion that the defendant failed to comply with previous court orders, and those orders required him to pay college tuition for the children. Additionally, the trial judge did not find defendant credible regarding his income. His testimony did not comport with the marital expenses identified at trial, and she properly imputed income to the defendant. So that the trial judge also properly considered the defendant's prior bad faith in violating support orders, and that was to award the legal fees. Okay, let's talk about a few spots from our sponsors, and then we'll talk a little bit more about cases that were decided this week.
This is Tony Clark, Para Planner at Patton Heidi & Associates. Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they will live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Patton Heidi & Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. We are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Patton Heidi & Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you pursue your retirement goals. Call today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 1318 Route 31 North, Annandale, New Jersey. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor, Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC.
Advancing Hunterdon is an ever-sharp focus on the growth and prosperity of Hunterdon County's businesses. Advancing Hunterdon engages businesses within and throughout the county that are responsive to a call to action as the next chapter in business success. If your business and organization wants to get engaged, contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. Advancing Hunterdon, a roadmap for economic growth for the business community of Hunterdon.
Okay, back, and this is program It's the Law. I'm talking about some of the cases decided in New Jersey this week. I'm Pat Smits. Those of you who know me know I am an attorney who practices here in Hunterdon County and actually throughout most of the state. However, my practice is limited to family law type issues regarding divorce, custody, parenting time, child support, also dealing with guardianship proceedings, and which can sometimes, unfortunately, be as nasty as the most litigious divorce when families are fighting, especially in a situation where an elderly parent is incapacitated, and they actually fight over how that parent should live out the rest of their days. And very difficult, especially with an elderly parent who is suffering from dementia. This is obviously very difficult for family members. That is to be, everybody will recognize that. It's just sometimes how they have their own petty squabbles about it. But in any event, the next case I want to talk about is it's a criminal law, constitutional law issue. And in this case, the defendant, and these they used initials, RLU versus JP, the defendant appealed from an order granting a final protective order against him. And this was pursuant to the Sexual Assault Survivor Protection Act. So what happened is the defendant previously pled guilty to endangering the plaintiff when the plaintiff was 11 years old. Defendant was sentenced to a suspended term and life parole supervision. And he was also ordered to refrain from contacting the plaintiff and to register under Megan's Law. 12 years later, defendant approached the plaintiff at a convenience store where she was working and yelled threatening statements at her. He returned several days later and stared at the plaintiff through the store's window. Plaintiff sought and was granted a TRO, as I said, under the Sexual Assault Survivor Protection Act. Somewhat different than the prevention of domestic violence, because in cases where there's prevention of domestic violence, the parties had to live together at some point or have a child in common. And of course, this is a totally different situation, but there's the same protection under a different law. So in this case, the plaintiff sought and was granted a temporary restraining order, and then finding at a hearing after the trial, the trial court granted a final restraining order denying the defendant's motion to dismiss on grounds that the Sexual Assault Survivor Protection Act, as applied in this case, violated the ex post facto clauses of the federal and state constitutions. Ex post facto, the reason that he was able to bring that up is this statute was not in effect when this when these crimes were committed. In other words, you can't go back and, well, I should say you can't enact a statute today, criminal statute, and then go back and arrest someone for actions that occurred before this statute was enacted. So in this case, the trial court found the defendant had committed the predicate act of sexual assault on the plaintiff back in 2005. That triggered plaintiff's right to the protection under the Sexual Assault Survivor Protection Act. The entry of a final restraining order against the defendant constituted a parole violation and triggered revocation of defendant's parole. So on appeal, the defendant argued that the Sexual Assault Survivors Protection Act required a predicate act to have occurred after, not before, the enactment of the statute. And therefore, the final restraining order constituted an ex post facto punishment. In other words, he was saying that this law was not enacted at the time he committed the crime. The appellate division concurred with defendant's statutory interpretation and declined to reach the constitutional argument. So in other words, when courts do not have to reach the constitutional issues, they don't do it. They can reach a decision based on either state law or some other reason, they will do that. So in this case, the appellate division ruled that the statute, the Sexual Assault Survivor Protection Act, could not support imposition of a restraining order based on conduct that occurred before the effective date of the statute. So the court ruled that although plaintiff felt threatened by defendant's presence and words, there was no evidence of defendant's attempt to make physical contact with the client. With the plaintiff. So the, you know, he basically won because they said this is the equivalent of an ex post facto order, and a decision based on an ex post facto order. So that now they may be able to find something else, but not that. There was a New Jersey Transit Corporation appealed from a grant of summary judgment dismissing its subrogation action against defendants seeking reimbursement of workers' compensation penalties, workers' compensation benefits plaintiffs paid to its employee. An employee who was involved in an accident. So it would be very interesting sometime to see different judges make decisions on similar issues. But in this case, you know, the trial judge and appellate division dealt with the issues. And, in fact, the court found no intent under the statutes to treat workers injured in automobile accidents differently from workers injured in any other accident and any other manner. And there was a family law case not published, so it's not, cannot be used for precedent. But in this case, the defendant appealed from an order granting counsel fees to the plaintiff, which she incurred during a previous motion and also plenary hearing. And what had happened in this case, the defendant failed to pay his share of the cost of a parent coordinator. And I think the costs when people don't cooperate really can escalate, because in this case, the court had appointed the parent coordinator to assist the assist the court, and the defendant just didn't pay his share. So on appeal, the defendant argued that plaintiff's motion to compel payment for the plaintiff to pay his share of the cost for the, you know, contractor, and in this case, the the coordinator. Getting a little tired this afternoon. The coordinator, the parenting coordinator, you know, he was not, the judge was not going to put up with that. And so the defendant argued here that the plaintiff's motion to compel payment to the parenting coordinator after the coordinator herself had notified the trial of the plaintiff of the trial court appearance. And basically the court rejected the defendant's arguments, and so, well, that did not come out as well as that defendant wanted the case. So let me play a couple more spots, and then we'll be back to wrap it up. I wish there were more interesting cases this week, but really not. So let's play some spots, and then we'll be back to see if there's anything interesting that I can tell you about this week. I will be talking more, I think, next week about the impact of the new tax act on residents in this area, basically on citizens of New Jersey. But today I think we'll stick with the traditional.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
100 Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
Sabía que de cada 5 personas hay una que lucha con síntomas difíciles de salud mental. NAMI es una organización estatal sin fines de lucro. Somos empleados voluntarios. Somos la voz de la nación sobre las enfermedades mentales. NAMI te ofrece grupos de apoyo, educación e información. Nuestro programa educativo de Familia a Familia está dirigido por miembros de NAMI para familiares y amigos de personas que luchan con dificultad de salud mental. Llámanos al 888-803-3413. Recuerda, no estás solo. NAMI está contigo y no hay salud sin salud mental.
Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's physician referral service at 1-800-511-4-HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
Hello, I'm back. This is Pat Smith. We're talking about some of the legal cases decided this week. I was hoping that Bill Wolfson, one of my sports guys, would get here a little early because there is a bankruptcy case that I was hoping to talk to him about. Of course, it's always fun if he hasn't happened to see the latest in his area. But Bill is a bankruptcy attorney, very specialized area. So all I can do is pretty much read what the decision was, but Bill could give us a lot more information. So what else? There was a Third Circuit case, meaning that's a federal case, federal appellate case, U.S. versus Hester, And in that case, the defendant appealed from a denial of his motion to suppress evidence and also from the district court's application of a four-level sentencing enhancement. So in this case, there was an enhancement requested, and that's what happened. So in this, what happened is the defendant was a passenger in a vehicle that was illegally parked in front of a corner store with a knowing history of narcotic sales. So the officers approached the vehicle, and when they approached, the driver of the vehicle admitted that she did not have a driver's license and that the vehicle was not registered to her. As the defendant got out of the vehicle, the officer allegedly saw a detective, they saw the defendant, who was a passenger in the car, drop a handgun and as a result alerted other officers. The defendant then attempted to flee, but was immediately subdued. Not so smart of him. And he was charged with being a felon in possession of a firearm. So, very important. So, at that point, as I said, he's a felon in possession of a firearm and moved to suppress the handgun, arguing that the officer's stop of the vehicle was not supported by reasonable suspicion. And then the district court denied the motion, and I know that in that case, the federal trial court, denied the motion and ruled that the defendant's interaction with the police prior to his attempting to run away was merely a consensual encounter. And alternatively, the district court could have concluded that the defendant's actions were reasonable because the car was parked at a known narcotic distribution site. So defendant was found guilty, and the district court imposed a four-level enhancement, which the government sought on grounds of defendant's past history. So the other things that are important about the case, the trial court in this case had reasonable evidence to conclude that as I said in this case they could conclude that it's a little confusing. They ruled that the defendant's interaction with the police prior to his attempt to flee was merely a consensual encounter, or alternatively the district court imposed a four-level enhancement because of the seriousness of what was going on. Because the vehicle was illegally parked in an area that is known for let's hear a couple more things from a couple of our sponsors, and then I'll come back because I want to take another look. I think this case is, at least it's confusing to me.
Everybody over there!
Get on up!
Everybody out there!
Get into it!
Everybody right there!
Get involved!
Everybody, you!
Did you know? The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce has over 20 active committees that you can participate in. Committees range from focus on business and government to economic development to events like our annual business expo. Contact the Chamber for more information today at 908-782-7115 or email us at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Okay, back to this case that I was trying to explain. Maybe it was more confusing to me than to anyone. But in this case, what happened on appeal is the Third Circuit. I'm having a bad day. It wasn't the Third Circuit, although sometimes we happen to call that particular court instead of circuit, circus. Actually, they're generally right on spot on decisions. But in any event, the Third Circuit affirmed the trial court's denial of the defendant's motion to suppress evidence, but vacated the judgment of the sentence and remanded for resentencing. Now, that seems a little strange, right? But the appellate court ruled that the circumstances the officers observed supported a finding of reasonable suspicion. However, the court found no evidence to support the sentencing enhancement and ruled that it was not clear that the district court could have imposed the same sentencing standard or the same sentence for the erroneous enhancement charge. So, in fact, he won. It wasn't suppressed. On the other hand, they were not entitled to get advanced. The defendant, or I shouldn't, wasn't forced to face an enhanced sentence. So the one of the things that's going to happen from the legal news is Bob Woodruff is going to be a speaker at the convention, the New Jersey Bar Association convention that takes place in May in Atlantic City. Should be an interesting discussion, especially since what's been going on recently. A federal judge in Camden has granted final approval to an $84 million settlement of an antitrust class action against the American Osteopathic Association. Wow. So what else? Well, let me see. The tax, and I didn't want to start talking about that today because it's going to take up the whole program, but the anyone who is not getting divorced this year, alimony will not be deductible from federal tax returns. We still don't know, or at least didn't a couple days ago, what New Jersey is going to do. Are they going to follow the federal tax and make it not deductible, or will they say no, in New Jersey it is deductible and includable? It's not that the alimony is not taxed. It is taxed to the recipient. It's just deductible to or by the payor. And the reason that it is a win-win situation, and it really is a win-win situation, because in the traditional case where the husband pays the wife alimony, he can deduct it, and then she has to include it in her income. But he gets to deduct it, and if he's in a 30% tax bracket, that means he's saving 30% and taxes on the money he pays. If she's in, let's say, a 15% bracket, she only pays 15% on that money, which is obviously a huge savings to the husband and is a reason that he can pay her more money. But I guess Uncle Sam didn't like that, even though not only Deborah, but, you know, and I say Deborah, meaning that she has some, one of the attorneys here in New Jersey has written articles about a number of things. I will have her on the program again, but at this point, one of the big things for all of the attorneys in New Jersey is what's happening and how in the world, you know, people are going to deal with this new tax. Looks like many people will have to actually hire accountants. Good news for the accountants, because then the accountants will be able to figure out what the actual tax of each party is as a result of not being able to deduct alimony. And, of course, that means, as a practical point, the husband in the traditional case will not be able to pay as much to the wife, and the wife, of course, will need somewhat less because she doesn't have to pay taxes on it, but not as much as the husband will have to pay in taxes. So it's a mess. And anyway, I think this is coming to the end of this program, and back next week with, as I said, I probably will be working more next week and talking more about other impacts of the new tax law. Frankly, people need to get out there and talk to their accountants, see what they can do, if they can do anything more for planning this year, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this is Pat Smith. Hope to talk with you again next week.
The news is sponsored by the Hunterdon Medical Center. Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
USA Radio News.
Bill Barr will be nominated for the United States Attorney General position. I think he will serve with great distinction.
President Trump Friday morning with that announcement, but the president didn't stop there.
Heather Nauert will be nominated. She's going to work with Nikki Haley to replace Nikki at the United Nations. She'll be ambassador to the United Nations.
The president also responding to criticism from former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. Trump tweeted that Tillerson is dumb as a rock and lazy as hell. Now, in an interview with CBS, Tillerson called Trump undisciplined and said he sometimes had to inform Trump that he could not do certain things because it would violate the law. Your final unofficial closing numbers on Wall Street. Rough day for the Dow as it is down over 500 points, 558 to be exact, to close at 24,389. This is USA Radio News.
Hey, I'm Brant. So there's this guy named Jordan. He's a healthy guy. He's a dad of six, and he works as a guide in Alaska. And he goes to the doctor, true story, he goes to the doctor, and he's diagnosed with cancer, stage four. And here's the thing. He had switched earlier from medical insurance to MediShare, where Christians share each other's medical bills. So the question for Jordan and his wife, Jenny, was, is this actually going to work?
Our medical bills exceeded $160,000. MediShare members shared all our bills.
And it was about more than just the money, too. This is a real community.
MediShare is a family, a group of people that stick with you through the hardest times of your life. I just don't know how I could have done it without MediShare.
It's so worth looking into. There's a reason this is growing so fast. So if you want to find out more, here is a number for you. 855-90-PSALM. That's 855-90-PSALM.
A Honduran woman is believed to be the first member of the migrant caravan to have a child in the United States after scaling a border wall with her family and giving birth within 24 hours. This move is reigniting the debate surrounding anchor babies and birthright citizenship. Linda Vega is an immigration attorney. She joins Fox News and says what's next regarding this woman's plea for asylum.
If she's found not to be credible, she then goes before an immigration judge to determine whether she's credible to remain in the United States. But even if she's determined credible, that could take months.